The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Tim Smart is a Brit. He lives in Middle England. Really, right in the middle of England. Well, nearly. It's a small town called Dunstable. It's got a main street, or a high street as it's called there, full of those little stores that used to exist in Main Street America. Tim owns one of those stores. And just in case you're thinking this sounds a little too twee and old-fashioned, I should say the name of this store is Secrets. It's an adult entertainment store.
We've been here 22 years.
An eternity. Now, back in the old days, about 15 years ago, things were pretty stable, pretty serene. More recently, the shops on this street, and the street itself, it's changed.
The whole area has, over the last 3, 4, 5 years, something like that.
What's changed? Tim says it's foreigners. Foreigners have come to live in Dunstable from all sorts of countries, like Turkey.
We already have Turkish in the town. We've just had a new Turkish restaurant open. Fantastic. Let's be fair, we all like a bit of grub. Unfortunately, too much in my case.
And of course, along with the restaurants and their foreign owners, have come their families. Families of foreigners.
A lot of the families are obviously speaking their native tongue.
Tim knows that these foreigners, the kids especially, he knows that they pose an economic threat to the locals.
If they're walking down the road speaking their native tongue, they then go to an English school and learn English. If they then apply for a job for any supermarket or any position anywhere, who would you employ? Someone who speaks two languages or someone who speaks one language?
In case you didn't catch that, Tim is asking rhetorically. He's asking whether the children of local foreigners who've been schooled in English and so now speak two languages, he's asking, well, no, he's suggesting that they are more employable than monolingual Brits. And for Tim, this hits close to home.
My daughter's just applied for a job with a supermarket. I won't mention the names.
So Tim's daughter, speaker of English only, finds herself at a disadvantage, losing out to a bilingual foreigner. And in Tim's mind, this is because the British government has an open-door policy when it comes to foreigners settling in Britain and being taught English.
It's not a level playing field in my eyes.
Tim's right. It isn't a level playing field. If you speak more than one language, you may well have an economic edge. His solution is to pull the country out of the European Union and stop the free flow of people across European borders. It's not quite the same here in the US, but there are parallels. There's plenty of anger that we're letting too many foreigners in and then educating their children at taxpayers' expense, and that one day that'll come back to bite us. That's certainly what Tim thinks in his small Middle English town. He just sees it through the prism of language. If you stop immigrants from coming, you can keep the country monolingual, and that way no one will have that bilingual edge. Is this some fringe opinion? Maybe. Maybe not. We'll find out more after Brits vote this June on whether to leave the EU. A British exit. A Brexit. Many of those who want to leave say it's because they want to regain, quote, control of immigration. Maybe regain control of good old British monolingualism, too. Today, we're going to a few places where people are taking very different turns. Places where people are working up their bilingual edge. Hawaii. The Netherlands. Those are two of them. The third is closer to home. Now, language acquisition, whether it's for monolingual or multilingual speakers, it's something we're understanding more and more about. Seems like every few months, there's a new study out on this. Here's a recent one. Baby talk patterns give clue into early language acquisition. Children use previous vocabulary to help learn new words. That's the headline. And the kids in that study, they were all of 2 years old.
I can beat that, Patrick.
This is Ari Daniel. He's a reporter with The Big Show, a.k.a. the World Public Radio program, and also the public TV show Nova. And yes, it's true. Ari can beat me.
I can go much younger.
He's talking here about studies of language acquisition.
It actually starts way earlier than we ever thought. And researchers are learning more by looking not just at the sounds we make, but at a language's rhythm and pitch as well. You ready?
Go for it.
Okay, so Patrick, I want you to go back to when you were a kid and listen to this.
Neighbors, everybody needs good neighbors.
Oh, yes, I recognize that. I don't think American listeners will do, because this is an Australian soap, right?
Yep.
Neighbors.
Yes.
It played in the United Kingdom. I don't think it ever played over here, right?
Yeah, good job.
Not one of my favorites, I have to say.
Next door is only a footstep away.
In the late 80s, a British psychologist published a study showing that pregnant moms who watched Neighbors every day gave birth to babies who reacted more strongly to the theme song than those whose moms didn't watch the show.
That is the first paper which has shown that fetuses can be exposed to a specific type of sound and then elicit some sort of a reaction to them after they have been born.
Eino Partanen is a Finnish neuroscientist at Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. Partanen wasn't involved in the soap opera study, but it's inspired a bunch of his work, including a cool thing he and his colleagues tried a few years ago while in Finland. They took a group of pregnant moms, and for 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, during their last trimester, he asked them to play this, loud. Wow. It doesn't sound like a Finnish music hit.
No, sadly. Even for Finns, that would be annoying.
How do you find moms that want to do that?
Through friends and relatives who don't dare to say no, mostly.
Plus through internet discussion boards. And occasionally in the recording, the middle syllable of the ta-ta-ta sequence would be swapped out for a different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Really, Ari? Is there a difference there?
Yeah, it goes ta-ta-ta-ta-to-ta. Listen one more time.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-to-ta. Okay, I hear that, but it's really subtle. Just the middle syllable, right?
Right. And Partanen did one other thing with the middle syllable. Sometimes he changed its pitch.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.
And then, just days after they were born, Partanen played the stimuli to the newborns and used an EEG to monitor their brain activity. He compared it to a group of newborns who didn't receive the in utero ta-ta-ta stimulation. The results couldn't be clearer. Both groups of babies responded identically to the sequence with the different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta.
Because that second vowel's heard all the time in Finnish. You don't need a special recording to be exposed to it as a fetus. But only the babies who'd been exposed in utero to the pitch change recognize it once they're born. And that's because, just as in English, pitch isn't relevant in Finnish, compared to some languages, Chinese for example, where words take on different meanings based on pitch. So babies that don't hear different pitches in utero don't respond to them later. Or, more simply, babies respond to the signals they first hear in utero. And of course, these signals can come from one language or many languages.
The way I think of the early development is the fetal stage builds up specific predispositions to what we're going to experience later on after we've been born. Babies are not born as a blank slate.
Rather, a kind of groundwork gets laid in utero that familiarizes us with the world we're about to encounter. And if that world has more than one language, we also prep for that in utero.
A lot of language crosses the uterine wall, and so that by the time a baby is born, they're not an inexperienced listener.
Janet Worker is a developmental psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
It's a very multilingual city. We have babies growing up in all sorts of combinations of languages,
including bilingual homes where English and Filipino are spoken, two languages with different spoken rhythms. And Worker wanted to know whether babies exposed to English and Filipino in utero are familiar with both languages at birth, and whether they can differentiate between them. She and her colleagues worked with newborns several hours to several days old. Granted, it's a tricky population.
They don't talk yet. They don't point. They don't follow instructions.
So she wired a pressure sensor up to a pacifier.
babies will change their rate of sucking, their strength of sucking, and you can condition the sucking reflex.
Which is to say that how much a baby sucks, or how strongly that baby sucks, can tell you how familiar and interesting something is to the baby, like these muffled speech samples that Worker played, filtered to sound like they would in the womb.
In this case, the easiest solution seems to...
This is English.
This is the first time that this international exhibition has occurred in this town.
And this is Filipino.
And the year it's been a new possibility before it can happen.
The results.
From the moment a newborn baby is born, who's growing up in a bilingual environment, they listen preferentially to speakers of either of the languages they heard in utero, and they're able to track the rhythmical properties of each. So they're born ready to learn two languages and not confuse them.
Worker says all this learning before birth might be useful. First, it may allow babies to identify who's part of their community once they're born. And second, just from rhythm cues, babies may be able to track how certain words function and give them a head start on learning that language. All this might come in handy when considering early interventions for things like dyslexia. These are still hypotheses, so Worker appreciates a more concrete and intimate lesson, one she's learned by watching the parents watching their babies in an experiment like this.
It communicates to the parent that their baby is interested in the world around them and is interested in learning from the first moments of life. And we like to think that this might make them treat their baby as the curious, involved little being that they are.
Okay, I get it. Newborns, they may seem kind of unformed. They can't do very much. But don't be fooled. There's a ton going on.
And even before that, even before they're born, language is such an irresistible force to us. It finds its way into the womb, and it makes connections not just in the baby's brain, but also between the baby inside and the world outside.
Yeah, and in one or several languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's one or more appears to really affect how the brain functions.
Yes.
Okay, Ari. So my kid, who you've met and mm-hmm. played charades
yes,
with.
Yes, we had a good time.
She's bilingual, English and Chinese. Should I award myself a gold star for that? Does she have what some people call the bilingual edge?
You know, I asked Janet Worker about this in particular, and I said, does raising a kid in a bilingual environment give that kid some advantage? And she said that, yes, there are certain advantages, like in the realm of what's called executive function, the ability to switch between different tasks. But on the other hand, Janet Worker told me that often a bilingual kid will have a smaller vocabulary in each language than a monolingual kid, unless the bilingual kid is a really avid reader and then they can kind of make up for it. So there are differences growing up monolingual versus bilingual. It's not like one is better than the other. The key is that babies adapt to the language environment that they're in when they're born and even before. So doing well in the world really starts with doing well in the womb.
Ari Daniel. He's a science reporter here in Boston. He works at The Big Show and at NOVA, the public TV science show. He is also, hands down, the world's best charades player. This being a podcast and all, you'll just have to trust me on that. Well, Nina Porzucchi and me, we've been thinking a lot about bilingualism recently. In fact, the reason there wasn't a podcast last week was because we were both on the road talking to people about just that. At the start of the week, we talked to each other too. Hi, Nina.
Hey, Patrick.
We were speaking on the phone here, but each of us recorded ourselves. So, hey presto, it sounded like we were in the same room. Nina, though, was in Hawaii, and I was in the Netherlands. And because it was the very first time that both of us were away from home base on pod business at the same time, we thought, well, a phone call was in order. A phone call across 11 time zones. My evening, Nina's morning. Even though she didn't have to leave the U.S., it took her much longer to get to her destination.
I got here yesterday afternoon. It's such a blur, actually. I kind of walked around. I walked to the beach and then went and had some, like, noodles and basically then passed out at, like, 7. When did you get there?
Well, I got here around about the same time that you did, except it was 11 hours before. So I also got her yesterday afternoon. But
I've had a whole extra day on you. I've been out reporting all day today.
The Dutch province where I was is called Friesland. I know, it sounds like a made-up name. And the people there, they speak Frisian. I know, but it's true. I knew virtually nothing about the Frisian language before I started researching this story.
My first port of call this morning was a trilingual school, which is a totally awesome thing in and of itself.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, this was a middle school.
So Frisian?
Frisian.
English.
Yeah.
Dutch.
And Dutch, yeah. So they would learn, you know, part of the day in each language. So, you know, they'd learn geography in English and history in Frisian. And then they do math. I think they do math in Dutch. But it kind of reminds me of dual immersion back in the United States where, you know, my daughter is learning some of her math and civics in Chinese right now. And then in English,
right.
Which she does for the other half of the day, she'll learn English writing skills. And I think they're doing some kind of like
language arts.
Yes, science and stuff like that.
So they have textbooks in these different subjects in Frisian.
Yeah,
they have
yeah.
all of the curriculum in Frisian. Someone had to go through and translate all that. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's only about 300,000 Frisian speakers as well. I say only, actually, that's quite a lot. I think it's a little bit more, 360, something like that. I realize that's more than the entire population of Iceland. There's more people speaking Frisian in the world than speaking Icelandic. I mean, that's crazy.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I came across, the thing that's interesting about Hawaii or Hawaii, if you want to say it right, is that, you know, Hawaiian language is nearly everywhere. Like, everybody says certain token phrases like aloha and mahalo, like hello and thank you. And immediately when I got off the plane, there's all these different Hawaiian sayings in Hawaiian written all over the place. But it is a far fewer, like, actual fluent speakers. It's in the thousands. It's like sort of ubiquitous. It's all over, like Hawaiian language. You can feel it everywhere. It influences, like, I was listening to NPR this morning, the Hawaiian local station, and even I was just curious, the way that they say all the islands and the way that they say all the place names is definitely, they say it in a Hawaiian way, but the actual language itself is severely endangered. So it's kind of interesting that it's sort of all around and sort of not here at the same time.
I think that Frisian is almost the opposite of that. It's so interesting that we're at these two different sort of ends of the world and we're seeing things yeah. really differently. So with the Frisians, it's like, yes, you hear the language all over the place because people are speaking it everywhere, especially once you leave the city and you're in the small villages. But what you don't see are bilingual street signs. You don't get the sense that you're in a bilingual part of Europe, like if you're in the Basque country or Switzerland or, you know, one of these places where there's more than one language at play. You see these signs everywhere that let it be known to you that there are more than one language and they're being taken very seriously by the authorities because they got these signs up everywhere. You don't see that here.
It's all in Dutch or it's all in Frisian?
Yeah, exactly. It's all in one or the other. So somehow someone decided several decades ago that the city was where Dutch speakers were and the villages and the farming communities are where the Frisian speakers are. So if you go to a village, you see all the signs are in Frisian. If here in the city, all the signs are in Dutch. But Nina, when I was at the school this morning, I got followed by a TV crew.
What?
Yeah, it was a Frisian language TV crew, and they made a story out of, like, BBC America reporter, which was how they described me, doing a story on Frisian.
Is there a lot of Frisian language media?
Yeah, like, there is a public broadcaster that, you know, has a news service, and they clearly occasionally are scraping the barrel for stories to report on, and there's also Frisian language radio. Interestingly, with the newspapers, there are two newspapers, but they're both Dutch language. Kind of like the written language often defaults to Dutch, which is greatly to the annoyance of some Frisian speakers. There was a newspaper reporter and a photographer also showed up and asked me questions. What happens with that? I have no idea. Yeah, it was like a news conference. It was bizarre.
What were they asking you, Patrick? Like, why do you care about this language? Or what were they...
Yeah. Why do you care about this language? And, you know, I was like, well, I'm here to find out. And I wasn't able to tell them very much at all. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm all over Frisian TV.
Famous for making the news while making the news.
But I'm not... I can't claim to have gone to the beach or eaten noodles or anything fun like that?
Well, not yet. You know, you'll get your time.
I'll get my beach time.
I'm sitting here, like, actually looking at the waves hitting the shores of Kauai. I think I got the better gig. I don't know.
Nina Pulzuki, who one day will return from Hawaii. Maybe she's still staring at those waves. Now, I'm sure she'll come back with a great story about Hawaii's attempts to go bilingual, attempts that maybe one day will be as successful as those Frisians. All of which must make the man from the start of this podcast episode, Tim the Brit, must make him totally mad. People all over the world, they're making his beloved monolingual playing field a little less level. And that is it for this podcast. We have photos, videos, links, all of that at pri.org/language. You can also get there via the World in Words page on Facebook or Twitter at LingoPod. Please write us a review at iTunes or wherever you listen. It really helps to get the word out. Thank you. And the last piece of business is Guess the Accent of the National Endowment for the Humanities Funder. It's coming up again. Let us know your guess at our website or on social media. You can even email. That address is language@pri.org. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.